not only with their own sets of allegations, but also very clearly expressed views about these allegations, whether they ought to be taken seriously, whether they ought to be pursued, whether there ought to be accountability for those who perpetrate these kinds of harms.
And very interesting that the people who are raising questions at this point, even under enormous pressure, are the Republican and Democratic women senators who will be confirming or not these nominations.
Yes, this is, you know, these are political questions in the end, and it will be very interesting to see whether the view of a majority of Americans in latest polling, it's very clear that nearly two-thirds of Americans believe that sexual assault allegations are disqualifying when it comes to these kinds of positions, these very high-level positions. Whether we continue to protect people who commit these kinds of abuses has everything to do with whether we are able to upend the structures that provide this kind of impunity.
Finally, Trump is ringing the opening bell of the New York Stock Exchange today, just blocks from the Manhattan courthouse where he became the first former president to be convicted of felony. We'll leave it there. Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University, author of Credible, Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. December's Governance and Policy Committee meeting will be rescheduled for January 21st at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Portland police announced they've arrested 16 people in a human trafficking crackdown. A state emergency services committee gets an update on Oregon's progress in its plan to move thousands of people off the streets and into housing. And new efforts to save the oaks and prairie lands of the Willamette Valley. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 12, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Portland police have announced that a human trafficking mission has resulted in 16 arrests, mainly men from Portland, Tigard, Gresham, Vancouver, and Happy Valley. Police say last week they continued patrols along Northeast 82nd Avenue and Sandy Boulevard, responding to community complaints, and they observed criminal activity and made the arrest for commercial sexual solicitation and unlawful prostitution procurement. The Police Victim Services Unit partners with Safety Compass, a nonprofit group that offers help for people younger than 25 who are survivors of sexual exploitation and trafficking. Members of an emergency committee of Oregon state lawmakers heard an update this week on what's been accomplished in the state's goal of getting more than 11,000 people housed and off the streets this year. They listened to Mike Zavara from the Housing and Community Services Department.
It's great to be with you again to provide a brief update on the emergency homelessness response work that the agency and its partners have been undergoing. I wanted to just start off with a brief story that we have really been trying to lean into over the past few months. We've been really digging into the numbers and really looking at the impact at large. And we also know that the impact for individuals is a really powerful part of helping to understand the effectiveness of these services and the impact that these are making. This is a partner story from Yamhill County, and just a really important nod to some of the unique ways that folks have been able to get served. This family, Michael and Edith, are just one example of a family that's been able to be rehoused in Yamhill County. They've continued to really share some really exciting updates and news stories. I think one of the things that I really appreciated about this story was that they were able to sort of focus on things that so many of us can take for granted. Things like a stove, a closet, beds, blankets, laundry. And so just really important to ground ourselves as we approach these results and look at these, that these are real people. These are people that have been and continue to be served by our system and whose lives are being changed. So I think it's just an important thing that we're trying to center. As part of that, from communities across Oregon, we just think it's really important to marry the quantitative results with some of these qualitative stories that are really helpful for folks kind of understanding the work at hand. I will dig into the numbers. So Executive Order 2402, Governor Kotek declared in this January of 2024, after Executive Order 2302 exceeded all three of the different goals. Executive Order 2402 really focuses on two main priorities. It's preventing homelessness for an additional 11,856 households, and rehousing additional households through the same system that we've created under the executive order. As of now, we have reached the rehousing goal for the executive order, and that at this point, we've rehoused 726 households to date. Many of these households were previously working under Executive Order 2302, and so they were able to continue the work with their case managers, continue those efforts, and then be rehoused in the last 7 or 8 months. And so we're really excited about the progress that's being made there, as well as the continued progress that we'll see through the end of the biennium. We wanted to make sure that resources were available through the entire biennium, all the way through June. We are looking to make sure that resources remain in community through June rather than ending in January. And so we have asked our partners, especially on the prevention side, to ensure that they're spending money at a rate that would allow them to get money all the way through June, so that we're not having a big gap between January and June where there's no prevention services. So we're excited about the progress that's being made, and also we're trying to make sure that we're measuring the results over a period of time so that we don't have a gap in services that's happening across the regions. So definitely excited. These data are available on the internet. You can dig in through a dashboard link to a specific community, look at how that specific community is actually performing, whether the prevention side or on the rehousing side. Balance of state update. This one's really exciting. So Balance of state had a goal of rehousing 450 households. And this started really at the beginning of the biennium, and they had the entire biennium period to be able to deliver these results. We've delivered the 352 additional emergency beds in the balance of state. And this is the first reporting where we've actually exceeded the goal for rehousing in the balance of state. So 555 households we have tracked as being placed into housing in the balance of state. This is a region kind of spanning from the coast all the way to eastern Oregon, as well as in southern Oregon. And so it's a large swath of the state, 26 counties in all. And we're excited to see that in these rural communities, often where there is less vacancy, there's very little opportunities in some areas, that communities are finding creative ways to find places to allow folks to rent. They're really looking at unique partnerships with landlords, with property owners, and we're seeing some of these results. Definitely some regions are struggling to get some of those results. If you actually dig into the numbers, we're seeing different variations where some communities have really tripled their goal at this point, and others are still lagging behind. So we're working really closely with those communities that are lagging behind to understand where their barriers are and how we can support, whether through technical assistance or some form of support or accountability, to ensure that we're reaching our mutual goals and commitments to Oregonians. We will be having an additional goal on top of these 450 through Senate Bill 5701, which is the Oregon Rehousing Initiative. It's the sort of the second year initiative to add additional households to this pipeline. So great results we're seeing from rural Oregon, and excited to see some of these future investments really yielding results for so many folks. A couple of things I wanted to just share really quick about some of the ways that we're also trying to think about supporting communities, really outside of the direct resources. We've also tried to create opportunities where communities can collaborate together. We've heard so many times that this peer-to-peer connection between communities that may not often talk or interact, community leaders are able to get together and talk about what is working for them, what the challenges are, and share best practices between them. Oftentimes, the practitioners, the people on the ground closest to the problem, have the greatest solutions. And so we're really trying to find ways of creating those spaces where naturally people can interact and learn together. Been able to see elected leaders, mayors, commissioners, folks that are really engaged at the service provider level, discussing and talking what's working, what's hard, what's not working, how can we make improvements to the systems, and really sharing those learnings together. I think it's a really organic way that we've been able to create a monthly cadence for those conversations to happen with a different topic each month. So we have a partner that is hosting those, really digging into the data, talking about implementing these creative ideas around homeless services systems. And then we're also doing a bit more of a structured learning lab with our partner, another partner, ICF. These are on rapid rehousing, which is essentially the model that we're using to rehouse people. And then also on emergency shelter, really trying to get providers of these services to the table to talk about what is working, to talk about best practices at the national level, and really dig in on those results. We're trying to really support communities with learning, understanding, and then building those collaborations together. We have a partnership with an organization called Reinstitute, where communities step up into a role where they commit to a 100-day challenge. It's a common model that's been used across the world now to really focus on a concrete problem for a very specific period of time. We actually have three communities, mostly in rural Oregon, that have stepped into this space: Coos County, Union County, and Wasco County. These agencies, they're the regional coordinators, have said, we want to participate in this model. And so they're going to be setting goals. Actually, a lot of them are meeting this very week to actually organize their strategies and set up sort of their system for how they're going to do this work. So some of it could be improving the way that the system works for a specific group, or it could be looking at rehousing a specific number of people in a short period of time.
Workers at Street Roots, the newspaper that focuses on the issues of the houseless community, voted unanimously in favor of organizing a union with the Communications Workers of America Local 7901 at the beginning of this month. But progress toward bargaining toward the first contract has been stalled. Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden says the board of directors opted to not formally recognize the union, meaning they'll have to hold a union vote through the National Labor Relations Board.
Street Roots was very excited to announce 15 unit eligible employees unanimously decided to join the CWA union. We thought this would be a pretty easy open shut request. We asked of the board to voluntarily recognize, and rather than that, they decided to tell the NLRB that they were not going to voluntarily recognize and are contesting two staff members. So I'd say it's not going great, but we have seen this before and we know how it ends, so we're excited to get to the bargaining phase. The board failed to post the appropriate NLRB posters around our offices by the appropriate date.
Hayden indicated the workers don't know yet when their first official election will be. Social media posts from the Street Roots Guild assert that the board failed to post notice of the union election earlier this week, violating federal law. The board challenged two workers who signed on to the union petition, arguing that they were actually supervisors and would not be eligible for the union. Longtime Street Roots Executive Director Kaya Sand resigned from the organization on Friday. When you think of Western Oregon trees, you might picture old-growth Douglas fir forests. But as Isabel Charlet reports, some of Oregon's most diverse habitats are the state's diminishing oak and prairie lands of the Willamette Valley.
The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and its partners have received a $4.5 million grant from the federal America the Beautiful Challenge program to restore more than 2,000 acres of oak and prairie land up and down the Willamette Valley. The project will draw on partnerships across 22 public, private, and tribal sites to restore native plant species such as camas and reduce fuel for wildfires. Lindsay McClary with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde says these oak and prairie lands have deep cultural significance as a source of food, medicine, and hunting grounds.
Really, these landscapes were maintained by traditional tribal practices, and they were relied upon as such. So restoring these habitats is really like restoring cultural lifeways to the Willamette Valley.
Once widespread, only 7% of oak habitat and 1% of prairie habitat remain in the state. This is in part due to the impacts of fire suppression. So one piece of the restoration plan is prescribed burning. McClary says Kalapuya fire practices shaped the Willamette Valley, and that removal of fire has invited in too much plant growth, making the area more susceptible to wildfires. She says oak and prairie habitats require constant disturbance, and the role of fire in ecosystems is often misunderstood.
I think this project is really going to help shift and change that social conversation where we can embrace fire as an important tool when it's done correctly. And it's going to lead to a reduction of those catastrophic wildfires that nobody wants to live through and experience.
Oak trees are known to support biodiversity like few other trees are able to. From large wildlife who graze on the acorns down to the many species of fungus that grow with them, oak trees are known to support at least 2,300 species. McClary says if we slow down and observe the trees, we can more fully appreciate them.
From top to bottom, there's a whole little city of creatures that are existing or relying on a single oak that we really just don't notice.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A contest to name a new Washington State apple generated more than 15,000 entries, and the winner is Sunflare. It's a cross between a Honeycrisp and a Cripps Pink apple, first known as WA64. A competition to name the Sunflare went viral earlier this year. The final name was chosen after discussion with apple lovers focus groups, as well as Washington State University faculty and staff. Sunflare was chosen because of how the name matches the apple's look. The combination sweet and tart apple has skin with colorful orange and pink blush on the outside and speckles that look like stars. Jeremy Tamson, Director of Innovation for the WSU College of Agricultural, Human, and Natural Resources Sciences, said, quote, "The name hits all those marks. These pinks, oranges, and yellows stand out against all the red apples on the shelf," end of quote. Kate Evans, a WSU apple breeder, said, quote, "Our breeding program exists to give consumers better apples to eat, and Sunflare checks all our boxes," end of quote. The new apple won't actually get to grocery store consumers until 2029. A special Native celebration of the new year is coming up in Oregon. Here's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
New Year's Eve, like many holidays, is often celebrated with adult-themed parties and alcohol. A Portland, Oregon group is offering a free event that caters to those who'd rather ring in 2025 with their families, minus the booze. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, it may be one of the oldest, if not the first, such powwows in the U.S.
The 37th Annual Sobriety Powwow will be at the Oregon Convention Center. The Native American Rehabilitation Association of the Northwest, or NARA, organized the event.
To offer a clean and sober environment for folks to celebrate.
Sandy B. Allman is NARA Northwest Chief Community Engagement Development Officer. She says it all began in the 1980s with NARA's cultural director, Philip Archambault, who wanted an event for those staying sober or just wanting to avoid the alcohol scene entirely.
And also, some of the local Oregon and Washington tribes have created their own sobriety powwow, and Philip took pride in that maybe they got the idea from NARA, and some did tell us, hey, we want to do our own, you know, so we have our elders, we have our little ones. There's things for everyone to enjoy.
NARA Northwest Sobriety Powwow features kids' activities in the afternoon and goes through midnight just into the new year. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
I'm Jill Freitas.
You were listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with occasional showers down to 38. Tomorrow, it'll be rainy, a high of 44. Today in history, on this date in 1901, the first radio transmission was sent across the Atlantic Ocean. Guglielmo Marconi succeeded in sending the message, the Morse code signal for the letter S, traveling 2,000 miles from England to Canada. The quote of the day is from Marconi. Every day sees humanity more victorious in the struggle with space and time. President-elect Trump and Kash Patel react to Christopher Wray's resignation as the nation's FBI director. CARE launches a website tracking hostility to pro-Palestinian speech. And there are changes that could give Trump the chance to shift labor policies. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's 2024 Talks.
After weeks of careful thought, I've decided the right thing for the Bureau is for me to serve until the end of the current administration in January and then step down.
Christopher Wray says he will step down as FBI director at the end of the Biden administration. If he chose to stay, he was likely to face firing. President-elect Donald Trump celebrated Wray's resignation, calling it a great day for America and claiming it would end the weaponization of the United States Department of Injustice. Kash Patel, Trump's pick to lead the Bureau, expressed confidence in a seamless changeover.
We look forward to a very smooth transition at the FBI, and I'll be ready to go on day one.
Trump continues to put devoted followers at the top of agencies like the FBI and the Pentagon, which have the ability to use force. But he is backing away somewhat from threats of retribution against his political opponents, saying success will be his revenge. Meanwhile, military families with transgender children are criticizing a provision in the bill funding the Defense Department that could block medical treatments for trans minors. The amendment would prevent the military's healthcare program from covering gender dysphoria treatments that could, quote, result in sterilization for children under 18. The Pentagon is dismissing claims that an Iranian mothership is behind large drones recently spotted over New Jersey. State officials want more transparency and a stronger federal response to the unexplained sightings. Unionization is on the rise, with the year seeing the most union elections in a decade. But the Senate has failed to confirm Lauren McFerrin as the chair for the National Labor Relations Board, which could give Trump a chance to appoint a new majority. Rutgers professor of labor studies Todd Vachon says the Trump NLRB is likely to look very different from the pro-union agency under President Joe Biden.
I'm going to anticipate almost all of these decisions in the past 3 years being reversed under the Trump board. We could be surprised, but I anticipate them all to be reversed.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations is launching a new website where students can report when colleges are targeting them for opposing the treatment of Palestinians in Gaza. Corey Saylor with the group says they want free speech for everyone, no matter their religion or ethnicity, and what they're hearing makes protecting it vital.
They're asking us to actually look at the university and determine if the university is a threat to the free speech and viewpoints of an entire group of people who are trying to protest genocide.
With the opioid epidemic bringing more children into state custody, some county officials are calling for better oversight of placements in group homes. Brian Davis, a county commissioner in Ohio, says a child welfare crisis and an overloaded system is letting some agencies profit on the children's placements.
We have to do something, whether that be regulatory from the state standpoint of saying you can only charge so much, or more funding from the state itself.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
In our KBOO News Health Beat report tonight, the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration testified to senators on Capitol Hill about efforts to reduce the chronic disease burden in our country. Here are some of the comments from Dr. Robert Califf.
I've had the great honor to serve as the commissioner of the FDA not once but twice. I came back to FDA because I believe strongly in its mission and workforce. Americans have entrusted us with regulating industries that bear the responsibility of producing and distributing products that are safe and improve health. While all the work FDA does is crucial, the greatest public health advancements we can make would be to improve the diet of Americans and eliminate the use of tobacco. The food we eat is contributing to America's unfortunate position with the lowest life expectancy among large high-income countries. I want to stress this, last place among large high-income countries in life expectancy. Nearly everyone knows and cares for someone with a chronic disease. 6 in 10 Americans have at least one chronic disease, and 4 in 10 have two or more chronic diseases. I am deeply aware of this because my 35-year clinical career has been spent in direct care of suffering people with cardiovascular disease. We all know that eating a nutritious, balanced diet is a challenge for many people. Products that may appear nutritious could be loaded with sodium. People can exceed the recommended daily limit for added sugars with a single 16-ounce bottle of soda. And over 70% of our food supply is considered ultra-processed. As a recent Wall Street Journal editorial put it, quote, Americans eat unhealthy food because the food system is designed to feed it to them, unquote. Meaningful change can only happen with serious action by Congress, the industry, and multiple state and federal agencies. And of course, we're here because this includes a major role in accountability of the FDA. FDA is trying to do its part within its authorities and budget, but successful change in the trajectory of our health depends on reaching a societal consensus that we will do this together. When we pull the levers at our disposal, specific actions by FDA can have sweeping effects. When we required trans fat to be labeled on the nutrition facts label in 2006, we saw a nearly 80% drop in consumption because consumers picked different foods and industry reformulated their products. Establishing a front-of-pack label could be another landmark policy. Displaying certain nutrition information right on the front of the package would allow Americans to quickly and easily identify how foods can fit into a healthy dietary pattern. The health impact of ultra-processed foods is at the forefront of current policy considerations. And the clear association between ultra-processed food and negative health outcomes is a major concern. Ultra-processed foods are usually high in saturated fat, sodium, and added sugars, and there is already substantial evidence of harm when these nutrients are consumed in excess. We are not waiting to act where the evidence is clear. In addition to front-of-pack nutrition labeling, FDA is working to reduce sodium across the food supply, update the, quote, healthy, unquote, claim on food packages, and strengthen our chemical safety review program. There is good reason to be concerned about the chemicals that are routinely included in much of our food. FDA has limited resources to deal with this issue, despite repeated requests for funding for much-needed additional experts to do the evaluations. There are years of work under each of these initiatives that are performed by highly qualified and dedicated staff in the face of multiple limitations in the existing science, extensive legal hurdles, and direct opposition from powerful industry forces. We have just completed the largest reorganization in FDA's history, in no small part so that we could take on the issues of nutrition and chemicals in our food supply. I'll be leaving FDA at the change of administrations, but I can assure you that our people at FDA want to do more, and we need your partnership. As a cardiologist, I spent most of my career dealing with the tragedy of premature death and disability, but my time in Washington has made me aware of how hard it is to address these policy issues. Our nation's complex financial and industrial interests, combined with our national instinct to favor individual freedom to choose, even if the choice is one that impairs health, make it difficult to take actions that have been successfully deployed by many other countries. And I believe these differences directly lead to better health and longer life in every other large high-income country compared with ours. In my opinion, finding a better consensus on these issues in America is not just an opportunity, but a necessity for the future of our country.
Dementia affects nearly 6 million people in the United States, and new research offers pathways for people to reduce risks and maintain better brain health. The new Dementia Risk Reduction Project, a collaboration between AARP, the Alzheimer's Disease Data Initiative, and the University of Washington, aims to better understand how risk factors vary by state. Eric Galatis has the story.
Dementia, a disease with profound impacts on families, loved ones, and caregivers, affects more than 55 million people globally. But new research shows that people can reduce their risks by making even small changes in their daily routines, for example, through exercise and eating more vegetables. Sarah Locke with AARP says there are also important steps policymakers can take to make it easier for people to maintain healthy behaviors.
When we do that, we can disrupt dementia, and that's a really exciting possibility, given that so many of us, as our nation is aging, are facing that risk.
Dementia is the third largest cause of death in the nation for people age 70 and older, and two-thirds of Americans have at least one major potential risk factor. People who smoke 5 cigarettes per day have a 16% higher dementia risk than non-smokers. People with pre-diabetes face a 25% increased risk, which rises to 50% with full-blown diabetes. Prolonged exposure to air pollution is also a major dementia risk factor. Other risk factors include alcohol use, depression, high body mass index, hearing loss, hypertension, low education, physical inactivity, social isolation, and traumatic brain injury. Locke says policies to reduce these risks can vary by state.
We can suggest to policymakers that they focus on ways to help people screen and correct for hearing loss. That might be a wiser use of public dollars to go after the problem that seems to be biggest in your state.
Locke says the goal of the research is to offer people pathways to better brain health and to give older Americans more quality time with their loved ones. The findings were released by the new Dementia Risk Reduction Project, a collaboration between AARP, the Alzheimer's Disease Data Initiative, and the University of Washington. This is Eric Galatis.
More than 5.3 million people across the U.S. enrolled in a Marketplace health insurance plan from November 1st through December 4th. As Kathleen Shannon reports, an important deadline is coming up this Sunday.
Open enrollment for health insurance is underway. Experts advise there's an important deadline this weekend. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, nearly 988,000 new U.S. consumers enrolled in health plans through the marketplace between November 1st and December 4th. Caleb Smith with Enroll Wyoming says those who want coverage starting January 1st must enroll by this Sunday, December 15th.
This deadline is something that we ask people to be mindful of so they can hopefully avoid a gap in health coverage. I'd hate for people to delay action or just forgo trying to get medical help just because they weren't covered.
Open enrollment runs until January 15th, but those who wait until the last month to sign up won't be covered under their new plans until February 1st. Smith says some families are surprised at the discounts they qualify for following pandemic-era increases to advanced premium tax credits.
I certainly know a number of people, they've done this a couple times, they just appreciate somebody kind of looking over their homework to go like, yeah, you got it.
I'm Kathleen Shannon.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eliza Yurkov, Eric Tegedoff, Isabel